session number 15736, Ernest Tompkins, reel 4.
Mr. Tompkins, reel 4. We were talking about flying the DH-4, and you were saying you had a much bigger engine. Could you carry on?
So that when you did a turn with this airbend, you could, you were sort of being dragged round much quicker than you normally would in say, a DH-9. It was like, I can't jump to explain it really, but you could feel the real power you had there, as against the old Sidley Puma. But the landing, with the aid of the incidence wheel, the landing was pretty straightforward. There wasn't much to worry about in the landing. If you set your landing round wheel right, that's it.
Now, you had to be careful landing the DH-4, didn't you, because of the engine. Could you just explain it? You had an Eagle 8 engine, didn't
That's
you?
That's right.
And why did you have to be so careful in landing?
Well, no, this is it. When I was up at Wittering, I was being prepared for 202. It was pretty obvious. The Captain Selby, he said, "We're very particular on landings." What he was meaning, I would have to be very particular on landings, because he said, with the Eagle 8 engine, we didn't have this, this is what I'm going to have. He was tipping me off, you know. He said, with this Rolls Eagle 8 engine, 375 horsepower, they tried to get down to a pound per horsepower, but they didn't reach it at that time. So you could say something like perhaps 400 weight of engine. And these engines were laying on, the engine bearers were extensions of the main longerons, the four longerons. And the bottom two, they were ash, the bottom two were extensions of the engine bearers. See? Now, you imagine bouncing a 400 weight, and they're only ash, mind, you see. If you upset your incidence, now your incidence is what they call the active resistance. Struts, and that is the passive resistance. But this is the
Carry on. If you upset your incidence.
Yes. So if you upset your incidence, you probably couldn't get your height. You couldn't get your speed. And that's our lifeblood, you know. You had to keep clear of the Germans. And I was taught all this up at Wittering. So when I got to Stamford, the first flight I had, that was with Lieutenant Bladen and Captain Biles. I'm talking about active service flight. That was in a 5997. We landed, and Captain Biles said, "Good show, Tom." They always said that, "Good show, Tom." I said to, when we were together, I said to Bladen, I said, "What was the good about it?" Well, he said, "As you know, we have to keep tight formation. It's our lifeblood. We must keep tight together." He said, "You stuck on him like a leech." And he said, "That landing of yours was perfect. That's what they wanted. I wouldn't have been able to fly with that squadron if I couldn't land an aeroplane properly." That was that, you were in one of the tapes, the D-Day tapes or the V tapes. It said, mentioned about the reconnaissance planes off. He said, looked up in the sky. He said, "Fast and high." He said, "The only way they could evade the Germans." And that was right. That's why we had to get up high. You imagine when I did the a Dutch patrol, I think it was 3.5 hours, most of it over enemy territory, look.
Well, we'll be coming to that.
Yeah.
Right, so that was your first flight, and then how were you introduced to Calvert?
Well,
the one that was to be your...
who did I take up first? A chap from another flight. I can't remember him being in our flight.
My first flight was on the 2nd of October. Now the
That's right. Well, Calvert
was
the next
day.
He was my permanent observer afterwards, you see.
What was he like?
A very nice quiet chap. I got his photographs here.
Was he an officer?
Oh, yes. There was no non-commissioned officers, pilots or observers there, not in that squadron. Not while I was. I don't think there was afterwards.
Did you get to know him well, Calvert?
Oh, yeah. Matter of fact, so well, they invited me to spend a holiday up at Durham, where he came from. But I couldn't. The job wouldn't allow me to go up there for a holiday. Then I had a letter from them, enclosed in a letter to him, thanking me for bringing their son through okay.
What was the job of the observer then? What was his role and what was your role when you were up?
Our role, if there's three of us, now I was in a position to be able to do a shoot if I had to, but we'll assume that the flight commander was doing the reconnaissance. You could also get in on that, and that was to look out for any German shipping as far as we could get. I used to go over Bruges and of course Gaunt. Bruges is inland port, you see. And that, if you will notice in my logbook, I did Gaunt Patrol, that's flying over Bruges. See the Gaunt Patrol, look.
Right, so the first two or three flights were just local flights and instructional, were they?
Yeah, but they still counted because we had to look out for, you know, go up perhaps as far as Newport, have a look up for any German shipping and that sort of thing, see. But they weren't so important as going over Zeebrugge or Gaunt. That was the main thing.
Well, the first operational flight then, real operation, seems to have been on the 7th of October, and that was over Zeebrugge.
That's right.
At 16,000 feet, and that was an hour and 55 minutes. DH4, I think it's 846. I'm not quite sure of the whether it's 60 or something. But can you take me through what would happen? How would you do a patrol, a dawn patrol? What time would you be woken up?
How would you be what?
What time would you be woken up on a morning of a dawn patrol?
And 6 o'clock.
Who would wake you?
Well, generally awake. We could manage to get awake all right, but there always somebody would give us. Oh, there was, of course, chaps would give us a tip, like, make sure we were on parade. And come back, I suppose, an hour and a half flight, perhaps something like
now,
that. Breakfast.
So you'd get up. What would you do when you got up?
Well, according to what job we were on, if it was, I can't keep my hands. If it was a normal reconnaissance.
Say the one on Zeebrugge.
That's right, where you go up the coast.
Now, but how would you prepare for it? I mean, what would you wear for a start? Because you went up to 16,000 feet on that flight. So what would you be wearing?
Right, well, we had the same all the time. We had our Sidcut suit.
Now, can you explain for them what a Sidcut suit was?
Sidcut suit. It pulls right up, down to your ankles, up around your neck with a high neck, and of course zipped up. We had thigh boots, fur lined thigh boots, coming up here, up to your thighs, under the on top of the Sidcut suit. We had generally two or three pair of socks, but generally silk to start with. Gloves, we had a pair of silk gloves, a pair of woolen gloves, and the leather gloves. If you didn't, you're going to get frostbitten. And
what about over your chest, underneath the suit coat? Would you have a vest?
Well, that was all fur-lined. See, oh, we wore our own protective pullovers and that sort of thing, you know, our own clothes. And the helmet that I had was a moleskin, that I bought myself. And our glasses came, goggles came right down around. So you didn't have to expose any part of your face to get frostbitten if you did it 20,000 feet, see. And if a chap got frostbitten, he's liable to get court-martialed, because they were doing that. Not, I don't say our squadron particularly, but it was known that in some places they were getting frostbite, so as to get a blighty, you know, to come back over here.
So you get dressed. Would you have any breakfast before you went off on patrol?
We could just have a boiled egg. That's about all. Have a drink. You can always have a cup of tea or something, but no breakfast.
Would there be a briefing as to what you were to do?
That would be on the notice board the day before.
What would it
the
say?
Night before.
Say for Zeebrugge, what would it say?
It would say the names and a reconnaissance between the map coordinates. They never mentioned names. It would be the map coordinates. And it would, like Captain Biles and Tompkins and Bladen as escorts, you know. And it would say general reconnaissance. And it depends on weather permitting, like. You've got to reckon the clouds got a lot to do with it, see. If you have low clouds, well, you couldn't do a high reconnaissance. You'd have to do a low one and get up in the clouds out the way when necessary. But normally we like to get up 80 to 20,000 feet. And
You get that. So when you got dressed, you'd perhaps have a cup of coffee, a boiled egg, and then would you get in your machine, would you, your aircraft?
That's right.
Now, what was the takeoff procedure, you know, between you and the mechanics?
We just normally, as far as the mechanic is concerned, because we had we just put the prop in position and we'd spark it up, you know. We had a little generator that would start the engine up. Got chocks in the usual way. When the chocks is put down, you get in the airplane. He said, switches off, air close, suck in. That is the procedure.
Now, what does that all mean?
Switches off. You've got a control. You cut the air off so you can suck the petrol in for priming, see. And as I say, you'd have chucks in front. And when he's sucked in, that is, give the prop two or three turns to suck the juice in. That's what he's meaning about air close sucking. When he's ready, he'd say, contact, sir. Now, he didn't say switch off, you know, contact, which is plane, but they didn't say, when it come to switches off, you've got to be plain about it, because you can't have a mechanic going, get knocked over with a prop if he's not in a position to do so. And then, of course, you warm up, get your temperature. And we're in threes, three of us. I'm sorry, I can't.
Right. Keep
my mind's on what I'm talking about. We go off in threes, and that was always the case. If the weather was permitting, and we knew that there was, well, clouds, perhaps not a very thick ceiling of clouds, and you could climb up through the clouds, and that was it. But if there was too much cloud, well, we'd have to stay down below, and that would be a dangerous job, on our job anyway.
So how did you actually take off? I mean, what was the procedure? They've got the contact, and they primed the propeller, and then what happened?
Right, well, as I say, we give a switch and the contact, and you've got your prop set at slow running. Look, I mean, I haven't got I beg your pardon, your throttle at slow running, see. And you warm up. When you've got a reasonable temperature, you got to make sure you can get your takeoff speed, that is full throttle. When you've got that, of course, you've got the squadron flight commander in front and blade left. Well, of course, he'd do a lot of this sort of business, you know.
Signaling to each other.
Yeah, that's right. In the aeroplane, we had what, I don't know, was general. We had a board, quite a biggish board. In the middle was just a big question mark. On the right, there would be a German cross. And on the right, German cross. And on the left, the British roundel. If the observer saw a machine, he wasn't sure what it was, he kicked us. There is a place you could put an emergency joystick in, see. But he'd only put that in emergency. He could kick the socket, and we could feel that. And you look up, and he'd probably be pointing to, well, the question mark. You see a machine, but he doesn't know what it is.
So you'd feel it through the joystick.
That's right.
He kicked the place where the emergency was.
You kick like that, see, and you could feel that. And then you'd look up in the stick, he'd be pointing. There was quite a distance between the two. You could sit and see what he meant. If it was a German, well, of course, you've got to be on your toes. But if it was an English, well, that's all right. That was a good way, because on a DH-4, there's so far between the pilot and the observer, but you couldn't talk to each other into like that, see.
And not that even was, shout?
No, not even shout. And that was our, we couldn't even use wireless. That was our only way of communication. Was by, as I say, this kicking the stump.
Now, you were saying that there'd be a lot of signalling between you and the other two planes on the ground, hand signals, and then when would you take off?
Well, that's it. It's the CO would give the signal, see. I mean, here you are, here, see, like that. And you're very close to each other, mind. Very close. And, okay, off you go. Just give a wave, and off you go. And you follow him. So I say, I nearly forgot to switch over to my pressure petrol tank when I first flew, but I still got used to that. And you climbed up. If you had to climb up through the clouds, it could be a long climb. And then you set course for where you had to go. And if the cloud persisted, you could probably come down and see how thick the clouds were. If they got too dangerous, well, you'd have to get back in and fly home, see. But we didn't have to do that very much.
Do you remember anything about the one on the 7th of October to Zeebrugge? Was there anything in particular happened on that patrol? That was just a
normal patrol, that was, see.
What sort of thing would you be looking for then?
Oh, the Germans used to have all sorts of... it's surprising. They wouldn't have... They could... of course, they had the whole of the... that's where we used to go into... The Bruges was inland port, you see. They could have destroyers around, mostly destroyers.
So you were mainly looking for naval targets and things?
Yes, but
land.
If we saw any German ships at all, you'd have to report it, you see.
But not land... Not things going on land.
No, we could transmit with wireless, but we couldn't receive owing to the noise. But if it's like take photography, I wasn't in the photographic flight. That was a flight, the photography. You had to say perhaps. Take a mosaic. Now, on the notice board for the A flight, they would have to take a mosaic between the two map coordinates again. And you would have to get your map out and see exactly where that was. They don't put names up on the board. and you'd have to see where this they wanted this mosaic, and you have a little clock that would change the plates. Oh, I beg your pardon. I think no, that was wind vane change the plates, and you would have a little toggle you could press, because you got, as I say, you've got to give so many seconds. When after you've taken the first one, you've got to leave for a little walk, and then when you get far enough, you press again according to, you've got to work out your speed and your height and that sort of thing, look, and so that you can have a mosaic, one picture cover the other. I had all these photographs and that all been thrown away.
Did you actually do that, or was that you just had been trained to do it, or did you?
I was trained to do it. I didn't do photography.
Now another flight. It says you were on escort to shoot. That was on the 14th of October 1918.
That's right.
What does that mean? Could you explain what was going on there?
Yeah. Well, now, that was the monitors we were having a shoot with. Normally, I think if you were in the infantry and the these old RE8s were doing artillery spotting, well, they'd probably fly at about 8,000 feet, but they'd have a good cover, you know, camo cover, SE5 cover. But, of course, we had to cover ourselves, you see. So we always did the shoots in three. Now, when you got your height, in the case of, I think it was about 17,000 feet we had to do that one at.
That was 18, according to this, yes. And that was 3 hours, 5 minutes.
Yes, well, we couldn't come down any lower because the flak would be too great, you see. Artillery guns would be after us, so we had to do it at a pretty good height. So the targets weren't all that big, but the cameras we had were marvellous.
Now, but this is a shoot.
Yes.
How did you go? I mean, you were the escort to shoot then, so you weren't actually doing the shoot from your plane, were you?
I put in, of course, all this is where I said, I explained how to do a shoot in there, see. You have your OK, and you have imaginary circles drawn around that OK.
Now, what's an OK?
That is your target, see. So, you've got imaginary circles. The first one, I remember, was about 25 yards, the next 50 yards, and the next 100 yards. And all those were numbered. In our case, they were lettered. Y, Z, A, B, C, and so on. Started with Y, Z. Now, we had what they call the clock code. The target was 12 o'clock. You always flew between the target and the gun. So your target is at 12 o'clock. If the gun fired, now to make the gun fire, you just signal G, in our case it was G. Now, you signal to the gun as you're flying up towards the target. They fire. You notice where it pitched and turn around and sent a correction back on the way back. When you got back and turned again, you'd perhaps send another fire. See? Now, if the shot went over the target, that's 12 o'clock. If it was, say, 50 yards too far, Y, Z, it would be Z. So that would be 12Z. That's exactly where that thing. If it was 3 o'clock, it could be 3Z. So that's 50 yards to 3 o'clock, look. That's how gun spotting was done. I don't know how the infantry taught it, but that's as we were taught.
Now, who would send that? Would that be the observer that sent the radio?
That would be the chap that, of course, I expect the flight commander would be doing that, look.
But would it be his observer or would it be him? It wouldn't be the pilot, would it? It would be the observer sending the radio.
Oh, it could be the observer, that's right. Oh, yes. Of course, they both, you all got to keep your eyes open, you know, for anything, but...
Did you all have wirelesses, radios aboard?
No, we did, yes, in our... but they were very crude, very small things. I've never had to use one, because, as I said, I didn't actually do the shoot.
You were the escort. Now, what would the escort be doing to... I mean, would you fly in formation with the person doing the shoot, or would you be above?
Just slightly above. You, without making too much noise, here's your leader. You'd be flying about like this, almost overlapping the wings, though.
Slightly above and to the left.
And you could, of course, here's your pilot here. You can see that easy enough. And you had to keep close. The idea was, now in one of those pictures, it said, I looked over the side and saw a lot of Jerry's coming up. And that was round about where Richthofen operated at one time. And we climbed up higher. And we could just about beat them. Like that. If I'd have dived, I shouldn't be here today.
So that was you were to evade German fighters?
We had to. It was almost a court-martial offence if you went out looking for Germans, because those cameras we had were so expensive. The Air Ministry's... I wasn't on that camera, that photograph. The Air Ministry sent for them before we got back from the Christmas leave.
That's a photograph of the squadron you've got.
Yeah. They were very expensive cameras.
Now, Richthofen was dead, of course, then.
That's right.
But he, I mean, it was just... You thought it was his squadron.
That's about... Well, I think he was at Gistel's at one time. Oh, Varsinair he was at one time. Whether he ever went to Gistel's, but Gistel's was about the biggest aerodrome there was in Belgium, look.
So you felt as long as you climbed, you could get away from the average German fighter then?
We could. No, what I'm coming to is this. I said about there's a lot of Germans coming up. Now, if we were flying at 17,000 feet... They couldn't keep a squadron of German fighters up there waiting for us. Even if they saw us pass over, they weren't going to be sure of coming back to the same place. But they could keep perhaps one machine up there, might two, but one odd machine could be posted up and say, well, you might see them coming back. But they wouldn't attack, because at Gistel's, the big aerodrome, they advised that, they said that no German should attack 3DH4 single-handed.
Why not?
Oh, they wouldn't stand a chance. I mean, we had a chap get on the rear of those three. We had speeded up machine guns. He'd have three machine guns on him straight away, you see. And of course, the observer can swing round anywhere, look, and the pilot's got right in front.
He's got a gun in front as well. So the point was that to shoot down 3 DH4s would take at least 3, 4, 5 German fighters.
Yes, I don't think they would... it would. That's right, it would take that. And they'd have to stay up there for hours on end. They couldn't do that, see.
So did you ever see German... Did they ever actually attack you in the air then?
No, they would have done. And we got away from... That's the only time I got near enough. This is the... there was a good... well, I'm going to say almost good relationship between the British pilots and the Germans. It's amazing. Here we are fighting each other. We were coming back off a patrol and we passed a German fighter. This is around about 17,000 or 18,000 feet. He'd been on a reconnaissance on his own. They did that. And when we got close enough, he waved. We waved back. That was the attitude.
You didn't try and... I mean, even though there were three of you and only one of him, you didn't try and attack. That wasn't your job.
Oh, no, they wouldn't. Not one machine wouldn't attack three. See, they advised them not to do that.
But you wouldn't attack him.
No, we didn't have to. Well, if he passed in front of you, the pilot could have a go at him, but we didn't. We had a job to do, look. The Navy wanted some information about shipping, German shipping, that sort of thing. I think people forget. All that you could get was about camels and SE-5s. It's all combat. Well, it's unfortunate they had to have combat. The Air Force principal job was to work with the ground forces. That's their main job, in our case, to work with the Navy.